Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hey everyone, thanks for joining us once again on The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, which just happens to be my bookshop. Today, our guest is Stephen Hall, author of The Raw Sharks Text, a seminal and amazing book that was released almost, 14 years ago, and published in every language in the world. It won the Somerset Maugham Award and should be, maybe, a movie soon. Stephen has written for Granta, Lonely Planet, and tons of video games. But today we'll be talking about Maxwell Steeman, Stephen's new book, which is being released on April 6th in the U.S. by Grove. So here's why you shouldn't read reviews, or maybe you should. First, Stephen is a postmodern author. I have no idea what that means. Second, this book has been compared to Raymond Chandler, Dan Brown, Albert Einstein, Christopher Nolan, Jorge Luis Borges, Thomas Pynchon, Mark Daniel Lewiski, the Kabbalah, for God's sake, literally, David Mitchell, and if you dump raw shark text in there, you can add Alice in Wonderland, The Hunting of the Snark, Jaws, The Matrix, Memento, Harry Potter, Haruki Murakami, Paul Auster, Stephen King, Carl Jung, a hyperventilating James Joyce. I thought he was just going blind. Herman Melville, Michael Crichton, Douglas Adams, Philip K. Dick, Steve Erickson, Ursula Le Guin, Beckett, Kafka, Jonathan Serafore, Italo Calvino, Peter Benchley, Mary Shelley, Sigmund Freud, Hegel, Jonathan Latham, Moby Dick, The Wizard of Oz, and I may have said it before, Chuck Palahniuk. And apparently, they always say meet, so apparently he's met all of these people. And then I was thinking, maybe he's written his own reviews, because that would really be postmodern. So in any event, let's meet Stephen, as well as Stanley Black and Thomas Quinn and his dad and a little black ball and Imogen, who I really liked a lot. So thanks, Stephen, so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me. That's a lot of people to be compared to, right?
I know.
There's so many, it's basically like saying, this is a book.
Well, yes, that's pretty much what this is. It's a book. So, because I own a bookshop and because people love covers, do you have your book with you right there?
I do.
Because I had a proof, I didn't have the cover.
There we go, there's the cover.
And did you come up with it? Did you vet it? Did someone...
Didn't. I came up with a version of the Rorschach cover, but my UK publisher sent me that cover. Was the very first thing they sent, and it was like, yeah, it's great. I love it. Let's do that.
I know. I like it.
Yeah.
I've said this in every interview, but as many people say you can't judge a book by its cover, every single person that comes to my bookstore judges the book by its cover, which is why publishers do it instead of the authors.
Yeah.
Because they want to sell books. So, and also, since... Again, the bookstore thing. I also love epigraphs. And in this, I felt surprisingly at first to see Stephen King, but the epigraph is Stephen King. And basically it's saying we don't really exist. But I assume the authors think about these epigraphs for a long time. I don't know whether you did or not.
Yeah, well, it's not so much think about for a long time as just kind of trawling for a long time while you're writing and reading and looking at things, and every so often coming across something that you think that says something so succinctly and so beautifully. I need to keep hold of that and make a note of it. And I just thought that that line from Stephen King was just so beautiful and so felt so very true emotionally, and yet was so strange and slightly ungraspable. It was just a beautiful piece of writing, and I thought, you know, that should go at the front.
Yeah, it really is, and it really does go along with the book. And then, this is your fault, but the title is the title. So I have to ask you, like everyone asks you, and I've researched it too, who is he or she Maxwell's demon? What does she do, and how did she come about? You might as well get
so that. Maxwell's demon is a thought experiment tied up with the second law of thermodynamics, which basically boils down to everything falls apart. And it's a very simple thought experiment that shows that in the right conditions, with somebody there to watch who knows what they're doing, you can make the universe more tidy, reduce entropy, stop things falling apart, and technically reverse time without having to lift a finger. And everything in physics says this should be completely impossible, and it's one of these real thorn in the side thought experiments that upset physicists for a long time and just seems to have a little bit of magic in it. And it's one of those wonderful thought experiments when somebody finally solved it, the answer was even more astounding than the fact that it was a problem to start with. So
yeah, I ended up watching like 16 YouTube videos about it, and the one I liked best had this angel woman opening the door and closing the door. But then I was thinking, she's working really hard. So then I thought, she's working really hard, she's giving off heat, and
she's not allowed to touch the door. That's cheating. I guess they couldn't resist the graphic.
I know. And then the funniest thing, which I guess is postmodern, which makes no sense because modern is modern, but be that as it may, I didn't know there was a zeroth law of thermodynamics. There's the first, second, and third, which we all know. But the zeroth is basically, if you have two hot bottles and they're the same heat as a third bottle, then the two hot bottles are the same temperature. And okay.
It's like, right.
Yeah, so that's the zeroth law, which kind of goes along with the entire book, I think.
That's really cool. And also that zeroth anything, you know, they always get put in last.
I know, because I've always, when I interview mathematicians, I always ask them, why isn't one a prime number? And they all get upset with me. Because, like you write, it's divisible by one, and it's also divisible by itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's postmodern.
I'm really not sure what that means. People keep telling me I am.
I know. Can you define it?
I think I understand the theory that it is writing which is concerned with foregrounding itself as writing and reminding you as the reader at all time that you're reading something that isn't real, often to the expense of story or character or narrative. And there's usually an element of ironic humor. And I mean, I guess I do half of those things, but I'm very old fashioned in that I believe in story and characters, no matter what else I believe in.
Yeah, that's what a lot of, do you read your reviews?
Yeah, not as often as I did when Rorschach came out. I think just because Rorschach came out and was such a crazy thing with so much noise, I just wanted to see what everyone was saying, and then was immediately swamped by this massive tidal wave of opinion, tsunamied away. So I've read a few, but I've not really gone out of my way to read them all this time.
So in the past year, I've interviewed three guys who have written books about human consciousness and why we have it. One's talking about neuronic activity. One says electrical impulses. One says we live in a manufactured reality that's based on survival tactics. Hmm. So I always, again, irritating them, I said, what if it's just a solipsistic universe, in which case only one of us is talking? And then they get really mad about that because that screws up their whole theory. Go ahead.
An efficiency argument, isn't there, that for simplicity, very few of us need to actually exist?
Which reminds me of Thomas tossing the Borges books behind the other books in the library shelf, because I thought, what if we weren't having this interview? Would it just be as valuable as having it?
I do think, though, that he probably wouldn't mind his books being put into that exciting, strange, magical space behind the other books. I mean, I personally would be very happy if someone did that for mine. It's a cool place to be.
Yeah, it really is. And that happens in my bookstore, too. And then I get all
really?
Yeah, sure. Because people just, you know, they put books back and it just falls behind. Because I always put them back on the top because I'm too lazy or I don't want to mess up the order.
Got it.
Yeah, it's like, of course, this is like cancel culture, but he was blind, so he wouldn't know anyway. But now I can't say that anymore, I don't think. It's like saying something about Dr. Seuss. And the other thing is, it's like we were talking about before. I also ask them, is there a ghost in the machine? And they all get upset with that, that these guys who write about consciousness. Do you think there's a ghost in the machine?
In what sense?
In the sense of, it's not just this wetware, that there is something else besides the wetware. There's somebody in there besides?
That's a good question. And it's something I'm kind of working on at the moment. It's exploring that a little bit. There's lots of, what do I want to say? I feel like there's something about getting older that you're more able to hold two conflicting opinions in your head at the same time. And a big part of my brain thinks perfectly clearly, you know, we're just meat processing machines and consciousness arrives, you know, is almost a mirage of itself and all that stuff. And then at the other side, I also think, yeah, sometimes when you go through life, you catch a glimpse of the machinery of how the world works out the corner of your eye, and you've kind of learned to pretend you don't see it and go along saying, yeah, this is fine. Everything is exactly as it appears to be. Don't attract attention to myself. So I kind of believe the first thing 75% of the time, and the second thing dials up from 1 to 25%, depending on how strange a day I'm having, I guess.
Yeah, and it's like before when I was quoting Pink Floyd, you know, it's like, when I was a child, I caught a fleeting glimpse out of the corner of my eye, turned to look, and it's gone. And that happens to me. Doesn't it happen to you? Like you just...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Strange things happen so often. So often. I mean, we live in quite a strange house at the moment, and we really should record some of the strange things that happen in this house. And it's a lovely old house. It's like a 500-year-old house.
500 years. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. The year we moved in, exactly 8:45, the door to the library, this is in the middle of winter, opened, and a bee flew out. It opened itself, and a bee flew out into the room. This is, you know, in December. And then, if that wasn't strange enough, the next night, at exactly 8:45, the door opened, and a bee flew out a second time. And so you're just like, okay, fine. I mean, I'm not even going to interrogate or ask questions about that. We'll just accept that as a strange thing that happened.
Well, even though I live in the United States, my house is 1775, so before the country started. And when I first moved in, every night I would smell someone smoking a cigarette for like a month. And I'd search the whole house. I knew someone was smoking a cigarette, but there wasn't anybody. And you could just, it's like yours.
Yeah.
And it's not like a moment of epiphany or anything. It's just like something like, what the hell's going on, you know?
Yeah, it's so strange. And I think almost we have a small section of our brain that just kind of is like the X-Files in the back of your head. And there's a little Mulder sat there and he's like, yeah, we'll just put that in a folder. Don't worry about it. It's fine. It's fine.
That's funny because in your book, you refer to so much modern culture. And at first I thought, you know, like whether it's The Lord of the Rings or Stephen King or X-Files and stuff like that. But it seems like you really like stuff, like regular movies, maybe the Marvel Cinematic Universe, you know, stuff like that.
I like stuff. I like things. I like living in the world, and I like liking the things that are in the world. And I like all things. I like very complicated things, and I like things that are not complicated but are joyful, and I don't see that there's a problem. And I like understanding the mechanics of things. I like... me and my wife sit on the TV and just kind of try and work out what's going to happen. You know, we're really bad for starting like long crime shows and trying to work out in the first episode who did it and then checking Wikipedia to make sure we're right and saying it's last 20 hours.
that makes my partner so upset because if we watch the first episode, like Agent Carter, I read Wikipedia of each episode and I just kind of drop. I said, wait, do you see what happens to this guy? And it drives her crazy. But then, you know, okay, you like working out the mechanics of things. And then you write novels that are like, what the hell is going on here? So it's like when you read like Never Ending Story, or especially when I was a kid, when I read The Meg, it's by John Fowles.
What a book.
And I'm going, or Sophie's World.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always thinking, wait a minute. I'm reading a novel about a novel that's about a novel. And then I always thought, wait a minute, am I writing this novel? And is someone writing the novel that I'm writing?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's that theory, isn't there, that it's stated, how is it, that only one of these things can be true. Either A, our society will never evolve to the point where we can create a simulation of the universe that's impossible to tell from the real thing, or B, we are living in a simulation of the universe.
Right, it's like a Turing machine, because it would take up the entire universe to...
Well, the idea is that if anyone could make a simulation that was as detailed as the universe, they wouldn't just run one, they'd run millions and millions, and so the chance of you being in the real original one becomes like winning the lottery.
I know, and that's becoming more and more accepted, you know, because you see it everywhere, right? Everyone's talking about it. Like the idea of a froth and a multiverse and all that. It's almost given now.
Yeah. I saw a headline for a science article that said that all matter is actually a hologram projected from the edge of the known universe. And I thought, yeah, probably, you know, put it in the box with the ghost and the bee in the back of my brain and just kind of quietly accept it and move forward.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I used to think when I went to sleep, my mother and father took the entire universe apart because they didn't. And then when they put it back together before I woke up.
That's amazing. Wow. That's so cool.
I know. I wish I could write. Because if I could write, I could write that. Well, you can write that story.
That's great. Isn't it? I mean, I kind of vaguely remember, you know, the things I thought before I understood how things really work. Like thinking that... spider webs were unfinished spiders, and you had to knock them down before they finished drawing together to make a spider.
That's a good one too.
Yeah.
And the thing is it makes sense.
Yeah.
It is like entropy. Why should they waste all the energy of the universe while I'm sleeping and don't need it?
Yeah. Yeah, just draw the curtain. Close that down, shut it down until you wake up.
But you know, it's funny because like postmodernism and the fourth wall. They say, and you know, you're kind of hung up on Ahab and Melville in the book. And they say, I interviewed a guy who wrote a book called Why Read Moby Dick. He was a little obsessed. He said, you can predict everything that ever happened, like Nostradamus, everything that will ever happen. I said, you can predict the presidency of Donald Trump. And he goes, yes, of course. And he said,
I mean, I like that book, but that seems a bit strong.
Yeah, he was nuts. I hope he's honest. But he said that Melville broke down the fourth wall one point in Moby Dick where he was looking out the window to the sea and he said something that you could tell he was writing a book. But it's like when Thomas says, it took me 48 minutes to write from here to here. What am I supposed to think about that? I mean, what am I supposed to think about that? And why'd you put it in there?
A lot of the book is concerned with the tricks that stories pull. I like thinking about the tricks of storytelling, almost like magic tricks. There are things happening that you don't notice are happening. And it's kind of interesting in a sort of Penn and Teller way to play with that and to put that front and center. Also, I think it's kind of fascinating that when you read a book, it seems so obvious the speed you're supposed to read it. I mean, not always. I mean, well, maybe, you know, some pages are made to be read slowly. You look at a complex page and you think, okay, I'm supposed to take my time here. But usually the rhythm and the structure of the prose is kind of flowing at a certain rhythm that, you know, you're kind of being carried along by it. And it's just really easy to think, oh, it's me and the author moving along at this speed. But actually, it's sort of a trick. It's the author is... you know, aging much more rapidly than you are to construct the thing that you're moving through quite quickly. And I just, you know, along with ideas of cause and effect and entropy, you know, it seemed like another instance of how time works strangely around books. And, you know, there is no time in books other than the time we bring to it.
Yeah, but then you say, and this got to me because... I'm old. So it says, you know, you're reading from left to right. So as you're reading, you're disintegrating. You know, as you're reading, time is going by. Mm. And the same idea in your book is that any change, you know, like the third law, when everything reaches absolute zero, there's no time because everything's stuck.
Yeah.
And there's no change, which I've always believed too. And I like the idea of reading left to right, but then I thought about, because you probably read a ton of Japanese anime stuff and then you read the other way.
I think as long as the machine of the book is consistent, the experience is kind of the same. But I do feel like there is a sort of time travel. And I think I do mention that in the book, that picking up a book you've not read for years does put you in touch with an old version of yourself. It's almost like a strange, haunting feeling of being where you were the last time you read that passage. And it doesn't always happen, but sometimes it can hit you quite hard. And I think it's because only you're experiencing time, but the book's tricking you into thinking that time is passing in the story, and of course it isn't.
Yeah, it's like I'm lucky because, the whole thing, the whole book, the pivot point is ebooks. I didn't even think of that. Yeah, it's ebooks, and that's ebooks presage Armageddon. And I'm so lucky at a bookstore because I read on my iPad, and in the bookstore, I'm so glad that every day someone says, you know, I want to hold the author basically in my hand.
Yeah.
It's a metaphor of sorts, but it's still true, just like you're saying.
Mm. And there is an intimacy, isn't there? That's something I was writing a piece the other day about things that books do best. And, you know, this idea that a lot of people think that books are kind of outdated and, you know, put up against, your $10 million Marvel movie, you're not going to outpunch it in any categories, but actually that's just not true at all. Something books just absolutely do best. And one of the things is that intimate sense of one-on-one connection. And the fact that you're sort of aware that you're co-creating what you're imagining and what you're reading, you're pulling stuff from yourself to build that world. Yeah. And just, I mean, I've always thought it was a funny thing, because when I did Rorschach, ebooks were sort of on the horizon and people were getting a little nervous about them. And the first few years I was working on Maxwell, everyone was quite terrified that maybe books would just disappear like cassette tapes, because everyone would just want to read ebooks. And of course that didn't happen, because people want to hold physical objects and they want, as you say, to touch that story somehow and have it in their hands and be connected to it. And I think there's also something about it being utterly disconnected from anything else. Like any device that you read on electronically, the world can interrupt you, or you can be tempted to read sideways over to something else. And it's a commitment to hold a book, I think. And I think it's a commitment to being switched off from everything else and just engage with one thing, which, thank God, that's rewarding right now.
It's funny because that kind of reminds me of what I put on Instagram and you liked, which was the idea of, do I spend my life looking at trees, walking amongst trees, picking up rocks, looking underneath to see if there's a salamander, or do I spend my life looking at ledger cards and manuscripts?
Yeah.
You make it clear which one is better, but how do we live our lives?
Yeah. Yeah. And, I think it's a really interesting question, how much of the world that we actually spend, you know, the energy that our brains and bodies consume, which version of that world do we spend our time in and exploring? You know, and I think we spend almost all of our time in worlds made of letters and pixels.
Yeah, and more and more so, especially in this past year.
Yeah.
Which I think is going to change things.
I think so too. I think a lot of people are, you know, that thing, you can literally miss something when it's actually been taken away. And what's been taken away is just everything outside your door. And yeah, it puts it all into stark relief, doesn't it? Just, you know, when you have an opportunity to go out and don't and spend all your time in online or in inner worlds, you know, that's fine because you could go out. But as soon as that, the trees and the rivers and everything are gone, then my God, you miss them. And the people, the real people talking in real time.
Yeah, I know. It's like for many things for me, I mean, a year is like a tenth of my life. So it's like, yeah. And so also that affects time too, because you didn't do anything. Well, you did, but you didn't travel and do the things you used to do. So it's like when I think back, it doesn't seem right. It's out of kilter. It doesn't work the same way it did before.
Yeah, because your brain, it seems to slow down because it makes more effort to process new experience. So if you're not having the new experience, time seems to race by. So we're in that, but we're also in that really weird phase where a year seems like it's gone by in a week and there's been a decade at the same time, strangely.
Yeah, I know. And then again, you know, all the other things we were worried about, like climate change and whatever, is just kind of shoved to the side.
Yeah, I mean, it's all out there waiting for us. I mean, hopefully it won't all be on fire when we can finally go out there again.
Hey, I just thought of something. We have to try to sell your book, so you need to, you need to tell us a little bit about your book.
Yeah, let me do that. Okay. One day I'm going to write something that's easy to sum up in a couple of sentences, and I've never, ever managed it. And I talk to the various people whose job it's been to sell my books or my projects, and we all just kind of commiserate how hard they are to sum up. But I guess the best way of doing it is to talk through the setup, really, which is the protagonist and narrator is a failed writer and the son of a very successful writer. Now, his very successful father took on an assistant who became his protege, who became another very successful writer who's the same age as the narrator. So the narrator has this kind of double anxiety of not living up to his father's reputation and his father kind of replacing him with a son that he thinks is better than him. And so when the book starts, he's holed up and he's writing tie-in material for intellectual property and sci-fi franchises and those sorts of things. And out of the blue, he gets a phone call, which seems to be from his father. And it seems to be almost a nonsense sentence. And he hears his voice. He's used to hearing his father's voice because his father was also a reporter. So he's on the radio all the time. So he hears this voice coming through his answer machine. And at first he doesn't think there's anything strange about it. And then he realizes it's a phone call and he runs to the answer phone. And it seems as though his father's just left him a message, even though his father's been dead for 7 years. And that's sort of the start of the story.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Thomas. He's in a very bad way when this happens.
Yeah.
And I like the way that he describes himself in the very beginning as almost like a rotting tool shed.
Mm-hmm.
Because it kind of gave me a way out to explain my life. I can be a rotting tool shed. And then also Sophie Almonds, it's like he describes her, but then he says she's diminished too. At one point she was like a sphinx.
Mm-hmm.
She's diminished. All which again tends toward entropy. I mean, either Thomas was always that way or he became that way. You know, and it's also like, remember when you described that beer and the foam on the beer? And that was also kind of a gnomon of the entire book because it was like the foam is kind of dissipating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But at the very beginning, you have a pressed flower in an encyclopedia, which shouldn't be there. And is the one thing that isn't decaying, isn't disappearing. And so everything else we see in the first chunk of the book is heavily affected by entropy. And yet, you know, this flower somehow exists, and Thomas really didn't know his mum pressed it before she died. And so there's this idea, and he's kind of drawn also to this idea that maybe there is a little bit of wiggle room and a little bit of magic in that entropy and decay and time is really only driven by probability. And it is possible that something incredibly improbable can happen that can get you out of a collapsing situation, which I guess is very much where the book is going and what it's about.
Yeah, and also his library, he's very conscious of the way his books are arranged in his library, and he's also conscious of Stanley's first book, and that when he knocks Borges' books behind, it's because he's leaving a space for the second book.
Mm-hmm.
Funny, because then I thought of Borges, and I remembered something, and he said if he were asked to name the chief event of his life, he would say it was his father's library.
Wow.
I know.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. And if you think about it, you know, it's funny because I used to do other things, practice law, build houses and stuff. And then when I had the bookshop starting, sometimes I would think, you know what? I did all this stuff and now I'm just like a shopkeeper. And I used to denigrate myself for that. But then I realized, what really better could you do? You know?
Yeah. Stories are the most important thing, I think. Because there's so many different things, but they're routes to think your way out of situations, into other situations, imagine other ways of being. I mean, I've done some reading about why we're drawn to stories and, you know, how our brain works to reward us when we're listening to a story. And it's all to do with, you know, early man, somebody's telling you a story about almost being killed by a bear and they didn't quite die, and that's very exciting to you, and there's a strong evolutionary reason why you should want to prick up your ears and pay attention to how this guy managed to not get eaten by the bear. And that's kind of the root of why we're drawn to stories. And it's very basic, like ancient level. It's about learning and it's about putting yourself in other people's situations so you can manage your own life differently. So it's vital, really.
Yeah, well, I guess it's like the explanation of the universe, where it's tortoises all the way down. It's, I guess it's stories all the way down.
Yeah, yeah. And without wanting to spoil the book, I mean, that's kind of the direction it starts heading in.
Yeah, I always tend to go towards spoilers, so you just have to stop me. Because
that's fine.
Yeah, that one's not bad. Yeah, that would be interesting to say, okay, what could you say that would spoil this book? Not spoil it, but that would give away an aspect of it. It would be kind of hard to do that, wouldn't it? Well,
I think there are a couple of things. There are a couple of reveals in the last, I guess, 4 or 5 chapters that it's better if you don't know they're coming, I think. But then also there's a lot of stuff in the early chapters that's specifically there for once you do know they were coming. If you go back and read it again, things don't happen quite the way you think they do. And
I like the way
that's sort of good stuff.
I like the way that Stanley's character and Thomas's kind of acquaintance, semi sidekick at the end. He's such a nice guy, you know, the cop, and you know, he's like, when he calls him Chief.
Yeah,
it's almost like some kind of old, I don't know, Dick Tracy or some type of detective story where the guy has this constant helper by his side.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like that. I liked, one of the things I wanted to try and do was to try and find a way that you could do a mystery and a kind of a whodunit, which is really what it is, even though there isn't a murder, but that would, as you were going along, kind of talk about the elements of those stories and how they work, but not in a way that would destroy the story itself. So almost the understanding those things were the clues, were the breadcrumbs the detective would be following. And so, yeah, I really like him too. I really like the policeman. And I like that at one point he explains to him what his role in the story is and why he's been included. And that isn't breaking the fourth wall. It's something that he can do within the actual story because of the situation he's in and because the guy isn't who he appears to be.
Yeah. And he's still kind of, even when he's being told that he is what he is, or maybe, he still goes along with it. You know, he's still pleasant about it until one point. And we haven't talked about Imogen, if that's how I pronounce it. Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah, that's right.
I really love her, and she seems so, I don't know, sexy and beautiful, and she's got a great sense of humor. But I don't quite understand, well, one I didn't understand is, why is there a gap between the telephone call and what's happening on the camera, without giving away anything again? Why does there have to be a gap?
It's because Imogen is away. Say she's doing research on Easter Island, and part of the way they funded this research is to put up cameras so people can watch them going about doing the research. And something that they do on all reality shows that are supposed to be live, and on a lot of things, is they actually leave a small gap. So if anything really terrible happens, you can cut the feed. So there's maybe a minute or two for something to happen. And if anyone really doesn't want that to be broadcast, they can rush across and cut the feed. So it's not actually live, but it's streaming with a slight delay. And so I kind of like the idea that that was something that they were doing, and also that she was just sort of so far away in so many ways that there was a slight delay in the feed. I just like the mechanics of that distant transmission, that for various reasons, because they were running a delay, or because, you know, it was a very kind of old link up, they were running at a delay.
Yeah, I know. Well, especially bothered me when she told him not to look. And then, and that also reminded me of the Magus. It was like, why is she doing this? And the same kind of thing happened in there. There was a chapter in the Magus where that happened.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there was all this jealousy. And then the teacup. And it was like, I felt so bad, you know?
Oh, the Magus is so great. I mean, Maurice, the villain in the book, within the book, Maxwell's Demon, is named after the guy in the Magus.
So funny. That was a good guess by me.
Yeah.
I remember I was in London. I don't know if it was St. James Place or somewhere, but I was in the same apartment where he saw her across the way in the park. And I was looking out the same window. And that reminded me of the same things we're talking about. I'm there. I'm looking out the same window. So am I still in this? It's like Rorschach, because for the longest time after the book was written, two people asked me about the book and have I read it yet? I said, well, I could still be reading it. I don't know if it's finished yet. I don't know if I've read it all quite yet. No one understands it. I can't explain it to anybody. You know?
I mean, try selling it to a publisher.
Yeah, it's pretty hard. Well, it's not quite done, and you won't be able to actually put those pages in the book. I don't even know how the hell you did it.
Yeah.
You must have a great agent.
I do. I have a fantastic agent. I can't really explain it. There are things that I do in my work, and there are a few of them in Rorschach, and there are a few of them in this, and I kind of sort of felt like, oh, maybe there's going to be a bit of a fight, or maybe people aren't going to want me to do this. And my publishers have just always been, yeah, great, this is fantastic. And then people have reacted to it. You know, when I wrote Rorschach, I thought, you know, maybe 100 people will read this, and maybe 50 people will kind of get it and like it. And that's cool. That makes it worth writing. And because I didn't think that people would tune into where my brain was on it, but actually, you know, our brains are more universal, I think. And I think we work very deeply on symbolism. There's a lot of ideas of symbols in Rorschach, and the idea that, you know, when you talk about thinking or language, we talk about water, you know, it just always happens, you know, flow of conversation, depths of the unconscious. And so all of that stuff is kind of, it's all wired into us, that even if the story seems strange on a kind of signs and symbols level, it feels legit to us. It feels plausible. It's just all the things that are going on in your brain and the things it's doing and the way it's processing things, that I guess what I try and do is find those little things and find ways to make them work for stories, and to make people connect to things in different ways.
Yeah, it's funny because I remember in one of the few interviews that are out on YouTube about Maxwell's Demon, there was one of them where you said you had little parts of this from like 20 years ago. And I'm thinking, so what did you do? You just like, did you hear someone talking? Did you just, it just, and just like you were talking about now, just it popped up?
And yeah.
Like a paragraph.
They're just collecting things. Like we talked about with the Stephen King line, just collecting things, ideas, things that seem like they fit together, you know, things that feel like they're going in the same direction, even if it's only a feeling that they're going in the same direction. And if you look at them objectively, they're quite different, but somehow they feel connected. Just experimenting with putting those things together and seeing how they feel. And because I think we read so emotionally as well as intellectually, you know, and I think you can do a lot of interesting things with the feeling of connectedness.
It's funny because like now, like you were talking about with Wikipedia and looking up the episodes, now you have the ability, if you have a thought, like I did, I can go down the rabbit hole of thermodynamics forever.
Yeah.
We didn't have it before. I'd have to go to the encyclopedia and spend time looking at it. Now it literally takes a second.
Yeah. And even if you had, you know, a 24 book encyclopedia, you'd maybe get 6 paragraphs if you were lucky, or 3 paragraphs.
Yeah. And so I did the same thing with Borges because I love him and the library. And I started looking up stuff. So when I was thinking about that one quote, I looked up another one. And this is like what we've been talking about with regard to words. So he wasn't sure at the end whether there was going to be an afterlife or not. But it was like Pascal's wager. He figured you might as well believe it because there's no downside.
Yeah. So
he called both a priest and a minister to come in and just talk with him. And then when they gave the minister said, "It is not man who discovers the word. It is not man who discovers the word. The word comes to him." And I thought, yeah, that's just like what you said.
Mm.
It's like what the book is about.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it's fascinating, isn't it? And all of that stuff about scriptures and the way that God creates and all those things that are in the book are all, you know, I kind of approached it with an idea of the type of story I wanted to tell and the world I wanted to create. And I thought, I'm going to have to do a little bit of building behind the scenes here. I'm going to build these links between things that I know don't exist, but I'm going to build this scaffolding that makes this story, you know, work and build these kind of these ideas. And the crazy thing was, you know, like I went down, like you're saying, a Google rabbit hole, and they were all already there. And not only were they already there, but there were so many more of them, and they were so more blatant than I thought. I was like, oh my goodness. You know, all the stuff about angels and God changing people's identities by taking letters out of their names and moving them around. It's like, it's just all there.
I know.
And Moses and the basket of bulrushes, which actually would have been papyrus. You know, the story is literally saying this guy is coming down to you in a basket of papyrus, this story.
I like that.
It's like, it's all just there, and it's fascinating. And so, yeah, I'm just a magpie, I guess. I just, these things fascinate me. And when I've collected a weight of them and it feels like that there's a story that I want to tell that kind of is connected to them, then that's how
it is. When I got bar mitzvah, our congregation was somewhat conservative. So you get to pick your hop Torah portion. So I went to, I wanted to get everyone upset. So I went to Ezekiel and my hop Torah portion was about all these angels that had full the arms and eyes and his
wheels and wheels.
And no one was really pleased with it, but there's nothing they could do about it because it's from the Bible, right? It's like Song of Solomon, you know, there's a lot of semi-pornographic, but it's in the Bible, so you can get away with it.
Yeah. Yeah. There are so many strange things in there, or that were in there at one time or another and have been taken out for various reasons. And the interesting thing is the stuff that's in there that talks against stuff that isn't in there anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, that brings us to there. Why don't you talk about the two works? Well, the Book of Works and the Book of Words, and then what do you call it at Christmas time? The creche and the ox and all that.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So the idea is that there's this in the Middle Ages. There was an idea that God created two books, and there was the Book of Words, which was the Bible, and the Book of Works, which was creation, and that you really could study either one and learn about the other because they were perfectly in sync with each other and perfectly balanced. And the best way to be a well-rounded scholar was to study both, because your learning of one would inform the other. So they were kind of these two halves of God's creation was the idea, which is just kind of fascinating, isn't it? That you would be reading from a text to the physical world and then back to a text and expecting and finding parallels and saying this must mean this because this is physically here, but these words say this. And also how that kind of, from that, the idea of how we treat texts grows, the idea of sacred words and the idea that, you know, because religious texts are made of words, that these words are beyond refute. And because these words are in these texts, that we should trust these words even when they're not in these texts. And we should kind of revere words and give them all these ideas of the power they can have. It's just so interesting.
I know, it's like when you first read that in the book, your first reaction is, this is impossible. Mm. This is not the way my universe runs. Mm-hmm. And then you start thinking about it and you go, well, it isn't that, it's like Lilith. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a whole bunch of stuff about Lilith, but I don't know. I mean, I don't even know if anything in the Bible is true. So how am I supposed to know whether Lilith actually existed? It's like,
yeah.
You know, it's your decision, right? You leave it up to, well, okay, that's an interesting point is, I don't know, half the authors I interview, you read the book, the end is tied up. Everything is explained. And the reader doesn't really have to do any work at all.
Mm-hmm.
But like James Joyce said, you know, I don't ask much of my reader. I just ask that he spend the rest of his life attempting to understand my work. Mm-hmm. And so part of you is kind of like that kind of writer, right?
Absolutely. And on a few different levels. I mean, on one level that I think it's the most rewarding type of writing for the reader, you've got to make space for the reader in the story. And what I tried to do with Rorschach and with this book is to see how much space you can give the reader, you know, in that they're essentially making decisions to how they feel the ending comes about. And it's not that the ending's ambiguous, it's that hopefully the kind of person and the kind of reader you are will strongly draw you to reading the book in one way or another. The other thing is that I think a book that is all wrapped up neatly on the final page, you never have to think about it again, is just over. I mean, you close the book and it's gone, it's out of your life. And I think, you know, the books that stay with us and the stories that stay with us have that kind of little bit of a grit in the oyster that doesn't sit well and makes you want to go back and poke at them and see and test things and spend a little more time there. And that I try to write in Rorschach, I've said before, that there are several different readings of the book and each one has at least one thing that actively contradicts that reading. So you have to, if you want to believe this is what happens in the story, you have to live with something that's contradictory because that's just life. And because it keeps the story alive and it keeps that door open for you to go back into it and explore that world again and spend time there. You know, I listened to a fascinating lecture, somebody saying that one of the things that's so wonderful about Hamlet is that it doesn't quite add up.
Right.
Like the timings are all off. It's like he ages in like the space of what's about 3 years or 13 years past, and they can't have done, or, you know, there's these odd time discrepancies. And the argument of the lecturer was that this sense of not quite rightness is part of what keeps the text alive, in addition to all its other brilliantnesses. But it gets under your skin and it's an itch that something isn't quite right there, that you feel like you need to go back and look at it again. And I think the best books for me do that. And I think there's nothing sadder than really, really enjoying a book and feeling like you get to the last page and there's no space left for you in that story, that you've been kind of pushed out the door and it's been shut and locked behind you, you know?
Yeah, and it's like, but some people like it. Some people like that. They like to have a Christmas present. And that's,
yeah.
Yeah, we have our book clubs, which I call Fight Club. Because there's one side of the table. Well, it's like, you know, it's not like people would expect a sequel. And it's not like, although when you've got, when you, in the old days, when you would be on a tour now, it's not like people will say, why, what, is there going to be a sequel to this? Or why was Thomas so weak in so many ways? Why did you do that? Why couldn't you have made him stronger? And they will ask those kinds of things, but it's not like that. It's what it is that after you're done, you just have to think. And okay, you can put the book away or you can keep reading it. But you, if you put the book away, you really can't stop, you know. And Rorschach, you know, that's like way out there. But this book, at least, it's discreet in the sense that it's done, I think. Who knows? So it's done. And then all you, what you have to do is you say, am I right about this? Or is there something different that I missed? And then you go, that's when you go back.
Yeah. And I think there's a sweet spot between the dissatisfaction of an ambiguous ending where you're not offered anything satisfying, and at one end of the scale, and something that's sewed up so neatly that there's really, you never, your brain doesn't ever feel the need to think about it again. I think somewhere in between, though, is what, for me anyway, is the sweet spot of the story, where I feel like I'm surprised by what happened at the end, and I'm kind of rewarded and satisfied that it panned out a certain way, but at the same time, I'm not entirely sure. You know, there's that 20%, 25% that makes me think, but hang on though, really?
I know, and that's not to beat a dead horse, but with the Magus, the last paragraph, okay, there's the end of the book, but underneath it is this Latin phrase, which I've looked at and translated so many times, and being romantic, I'm hoping that it means they'll get back together, they'll be in love, it'll be wonderful. But the other side is like, you have no idea. You just have to pick one based on how, what kind of person you are, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's bothered me all my life, actually. Ever since I was a teenager and read it. Yeah, that's something that has really stayed with me. And you know, not as a compliment to you, which it is that your books do the same thing. It's like, what am I? Maybe it's not a compliment. It's like, what am I supposed to do now? It's like maybe you were waiting for a bus and you just missed it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not a compliment, but.
But I think from my point of view, from writing books and writing stories, what's important to me is that they manage to find a way to live and thrive in a weird sort of way. They are like children. Of course, they're not actually children, but they're something that goes into the world and you want to carry on existing. You know, they really are a part of me. And it feels good to me that they continue to keep under people's skin. You know, I'm sure you could write a book, and there have been books that, you know, take the world by storm and pass in a huge wave, and everyone's done with them, they're done with them, and that's the end. But, you know, I kind of like the idea of creating a book, spending a lot of time to create a book that's going to find a way to live, and it's going to keep coming back into people's lives after they've read it.
Yeah, I used to ask everybody, okay, you've written this book and it's like your child. I'm only asking you because you said it. It's like your child. And then you let your child, or your firstborn in some cases, go out into the world. Do you feel like my daughter's going away to university. So I want her to go, but I don't really want her out of my life. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's sort of what I'm saying. I feel like while the books keep living for readers, they don't go out of my life either, you know? And it's really nice. I still get messages from people who read Rorschach 14 years ago. Like, that book still, I still go back and poke at it every so often. Or, you know, I've just reread it and I realized that a lot of what I thought isn't what I think anymore, you know? And that there's a sense of the work staying alive in that way, which, you know, is just really rewarding for me. And yeah. Yeah. I mean, I apologize if it's just horrific for everyone who isn't me.
But it does mean you're a good writer because people are remembering it. And the other thing, my ex-wife has taught school for 30 years and she still has some of her students who write her now. They're now like in their late 40s. that are writing saying, you were, you know, you changed my life. You were the best, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It really does. Yeah. And I can understand why you feel that way. It really does mean a lot. Yeah. It's not like, not that there's anything wrong. Well, there is with James Patterson or, John Grisham, but you're not going to like, no, you're not, it doesn't, it's not the same kind of thing.
No. No, and that's, you know, like you say, that doesn't make, I don't think any sort of writing is invalid. I think, you know, everything that exists is trying to do a thing, and is it doing the thing it's trying to do well is the question. You know, I judge people who are dismissive of Dan Brown because, not people, no, that's wrong. I judge writers who are dismissive of Dan Brown because if you're not looking at a book like The Da Vinci Code and saying, yes, all the things people say, yes, all the problems, but that book is responsible for God knows how many sleepless nights across the world. And if you're not looking at that book and trying to work out what is that fairy dust in amongst all the things you don't like that has made people not sleep all over the world, you know, how can you not want to try and unpick that and find out how that works? I guess that's just the mechanic in me, you know?
Yeah, I understand that. You cannot like the movie.
Absolutely. I mean, you cannot like the book. I mean, you can read a book and think this is the most awful book I've ever read, but if you think millions of people have not gone to bed because of this book, then I'd still want to say, well, clearly there's something I'm not seeing here, and I want to pull it apart. And, I mean, I always want to pull things apart, see how they work.
Yeah, that's what you said at the beginning. But you're very kind, too, because if I had to compare The Name of the Rose with Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, well, yeah.
Sure. Well, yeah, of course.
Yeah, but I mean, you're very Catholic in your interests, like we were talking about at the beginning, like The X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone might criticize you for liking The X-Files, or even for liking Stephen King, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen King's brilliant.
And his book on writing is one of the best books on writing ever written, I think.
It is. It is, and I read that and was blown away by it, and then kind of had a literal punched in the stomach moment when I saw Rorschach test listed at the back on the reading list.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it was just wonderful for me. And I started, some of the first novels I ever read as a way too young kid with Stephen King's books, because my mum was a huge horror fan and she was quite keen that she'd be able to read a book at lunchtime uninterrupted. So I'd get given one as well. And so, yeah, I have like big emotional reaction to those books, but I've gone back through them all recently and God, he can put a story together, that man.
There was one review of your book that said, if you don't like Thomas Pynchon or House of Leaves, you'll be irritated by this book. And I go, well, what the fuck's wrong with you?
Yeah. If you don't like that, then guess what? I'm irritated by you as well.
Yeah, read a Harlequin romance, you know, then you'll feel better. I
remember once I was getting on a train. I was in a newsagent's, and I flicked through a literary paper, and there was a review of Rorschach text, and it was very dismissive, saying it was meant to be very cruel, but comparing it to Doctor Who, and it made me laugh because I'd actually gone into the shop to buy Doctor Who magazine.
Plus, you wrote one of the best Doctor Who's ever. And that's so funny, yeah. A lot of and then what happens is that's the other thing about the book. After you read it, when you're walking around, every once in a while something happens, and you go, "Oh, this is like the book." How can that be?
I don't know. I don't know. I just put down the things that happened to me and kind of accept I'm not that unique, maybe.
Yeah, that's why I like the part about him being a dilapidated garden shed. That really.
Yeah, and that's okay.
Yeah,
it? I mean,
that's the way I took it. I took it like, okay, I'm like that too, and he's like that, so I'm not that bad, really.
Yeah, we all know where we are at the start of this book, and we're all, you know, if not quite comfortable with it, comfortable enough to keep going forward.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, that's a good way to end. And we've been talking for who knows how long, 1 hour and 10 minutes.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, likewise. And I was looking forward so much. And yeah, And another 14 years, we'll talk again.
Yep. Yeah. If I can squeak it in under a decade, I'll give you a shout early.
Okay. If I'm still around, I'll dead or alive, I'll read it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.